come on in and spend some time with the film hobbyist. My name is Lydia, and I love movies. We're standing here in my attic room, just next to my Nook. My husband and I finally went through a couple of boxes of papers, making way for a new bookshelf across the room from my desk, so I've been able to move my books upstairs. There are the books that shouldn't be in reach of children, like my complete collection of the comic series Fables in compendium form. And then there are my favorite books, my worn copies of The Lord of the Rings, The Chronicles of Narnia, and Gail Carson Levine's Ella Enchanted. Next, we have my books on writing, including Stephen King's On Writing and Jeff Vandermeer's Wonder Book. Here's a collection of hardback journals I like to use for fun writing projects, like the fantasy retelling of World War II with anthropomorphic wolves instead of Nazis, and my Cinderella retelling, where I leaned into her talking to birds. Finally, here are my reference texts, largely my dictionaries and fairy tale collections, including George MacDonald, Hans Christian Andersen, and the Brothers Grimm. I fell deeply in love with fairy tales around fourth grade, and I don't mean Disney princess stories. I mean fairy tales, like knowing Charles Perrault's Sleeping Beauty has a second half where the prince's mother is an ogre and she tries to eat the princess and her two children while the prince is on a hunting trip. I really loved discovering the dark and twisted origins to the animated movies I'd enjoyed. It was like my interest growing up with me. I even dipped my toe into fairy tale scholarship in college while working on a paper. It was only tangentially related to the topic I was supposed to be covering, but it's the only part of that assignment I remember, and it's the kind of stuff I think about regularly when analyzing film and television. So I'm not an expert on this subject, but definitely a well-informed fan. Fairy tales are a very specific thing, and it's kind of difficult to pin down. Normally, when we think of the form, we actually just think of the stories themselves, their plot beats, and specifics. So, Cinderella, Snow White, Sleeping Beauty. But the movies you're thinking about right now, maybe Disney movies, maybe some gritty reboots, are often quite distanced from the actual literary genre of the fairy tale. We talked a little bit last month about something similar when we discussed Robin Hood. A movie might technically be a fairy tale in the story it's based on, but it's far more of an action movie or a romance, which isn't a bad thing. The stories of fairy tales have produced a lot of excellent books and movies that I personally love. But a fairy tale isn't so much a certain plot as it is a feeling, an atmosphere. There's a real embrace of instinctual plot structure, like a plot flow that is more emotional than logical. There's a dreamlike quality to the imagery and the cinematography, a character arc that taps into something more metaphorical than literal, archetype. Symbolism. There are some highly crafted, well-respected films that fit these characteristics. Some for children, like Spirited Away, Song of the Sea. Some for adults, like Pan's Labyrinth or The City of Lost Children. We might talk about some of these someday. But today, I want to talk about something completely different. A movie that was largely disregarded by the film criticism community, it currently only holds a 13% on Rotten Tomatoes, in no small part because they were judging it as a modern comedy. They found it saccharine, obnoxious, and uneven. And while it's not without flaws, I think that the 2003 film Uptown Girls is far less of a modern comedy than a modern melancholic fairy tale. On face value, this is not the kind of movie that I generally watch. I'm not much of a chick flick person. I have my favorites, but I doubt I would ever have watched this film if I hadn't lived in a girl's dorm before the advent of quality streaming services. My university library was an excellent resource for prestigious film. They had a great many Best Picture nominees and winners, some nice selections from the Criterion Collection, a healthy representation of international film. But if you just wanted a movie to throw on in the background while you solved problems for applied algebra, you could only rely on DVDs you and the people around you had bothered to bring to college. Which is how I ended up perusing my roommate's DVD collection. I'd picked through her choices alphabetically, and now there was only Uptown Girls left. The title calls to mind the song by Billy Joel, Uptown Girl, where he sings about a rich girl in a white bread world coming to look for an adventure by falling in love with a downtown man, a lower-income guy with a beating heart and big dreams. The music video is a woman in 80s couture, echoing Christian Dior's new look, standing and smiling while Billy Joel and his backup singers bop about dressed as mechanics. So you might think that this was kind of a romance about wealthy women falling for lower-income guys. It is not. Which I discovered as I looked at the cover. With a white background, on which is superimposed the New York skyline in faded pastels, there stands Brittany Murphy in a skin-tight, white, spaghetti-strapped dress with a lacy neckline, her blonde curls thrown to the side with sexy bimbo energy, her arms thrown around a young Dakota Fanning in a navy and white school uniform, clutching a folder, her eyes mid-roll. So you might think that this movie is an odd couple comedy about a dumb blonde and a nerdy child. Only sort of. Uptown Girls tells the story of Molly, the 22-year-old orphan daughter of a rock star living a charmed life in New York City, who wakes up one day to discover that her father's accountant has stolen all of her money and fled, leaving her penniless. Forced to get an actual job, she stumbles on a gig nannying an 8-year-old girl, a highly disciplined hypochondriac named Ray. Ray's high demands have led to a high turnover of nannies, but Molly desperately needs the income. Plot ensues. And yet, this movie has something that isn't articulated in its title, or marketing, or plot synopsis. And if you go into it on those obvious terms, especially if that's the kind of story you're hoping to see, you're probably going to be baffled. Because this movie's director, Boaz Yakin, brings the imagery and feel of a fairy tale to what should be, on paper, a mediocre, predictable comedy. And he finds something completely heartbreaking there. You might ask, why would a director randomly pick to turn an odd couple comedy into a fairy tale? Well, the script gave him the idea. The opening lines of this film are as follows. Some fairy tales are true. Most other stories we make up to help us deal with real life. It all depends on your point of view. But here are the facts. There was once a princess who lived in a castle high above the streets of an enchanted kingdom. The king and queen were long gone, but they left her with their treasure so that she could stay a princess forever. On the eve of her 22nd birthday, a great celebration was planned. Now, this kind of monologue opening a script doesn't guarantee that your film is tonally a fairy tale. There was actually a bit of a trend in the late 90s, early 2000s to have movies start with a once upon a time fairy tale monologue, only to undercut that with a tonal shift. This was part of a trend of fairy tale deconstruction, influenced by postmodernism and third wave feminism. There's Ever After, which, while utterly sincere in its storytelling, is a realistic deconstruction of Cinderella. Then there's Shrek, which is not sincere, and where the opening fairy tale is literally ripped and turned into toilet paper. There are movies like A Knight's Tale, where the once upon a time isn't literal, but is heavily implied in the serious opening scroll. There's Moulin Rouge, where the storybook opening is sung in a cover of Nat King Cole's Nature Boy. I suspect that the screenwriters merely intended this monologue as a device, a juxtaposition for the very modern story that was to come next, especially since the story is about a protagonist stuck in girlhood. Instead, this monologue is the lens through which Joaquin sets the whole film, and it's what takes this movie from being a mediocre, forgettable time waster to a compelling, interesting, flawed, but good film, one that's actually become a bit of a cult classic. We can tell the difference immediately. Those previous films have an abrupt musical tonal shift shortly after their openings. Shrek goes from fairy tale to Smash Mouth's All-Star. A Knight's Tale launches into We Will Rock You in the jousting stands. Moulin Rouge has a narcoleptic Argentinian crash through a wall, shortly followed by Ewan McGregor belting The Sound of Music. Even a movie like The Princess Diaries goes from sweet strings to an aggressive pop song. This movie never makes that tonal shift. It does move from an orchestral score to a needle drop, but it chooses the softer pop tones of Lee Nash's Charmed Life, whose lyrics specifically reference fairy tales, stories, and magic. This film is choosing to lean into the fairy tale instead of using it as a contrast. So how does a director communicate that his film is a fairy tale, especially without the convenience of a fairy tale setting or plot? First, it starts with the cinematography. Early 2000s chick flicks tend to feature very standard, typical shot setups and choices. Wide shots with controlled pans, static, medium shots, close-ups for personal moments. Cameras are pretty static or very stable. They're not showy or very artful. They don't need to be. The audience is here for the stories, and so the filmmaking doesn't distract from that. This camera is frequently in motion. There's a reoccurring motif of spinning, which is actually emphasizing something about the plot, which we'll get to later. What you need to know is this film is filled with whip pans of varying speeds. There's quite a bit of Steadicam use, too. Not in the documentarian handheld style explored in action films shortly after this, but in a smooth, whimsical way. Molly is the sort of character who doesn't really walk in a straight line. She almost dances more than walks, and the camera follows her lead. The lighting is really interesting, too. Early 2000s chick flicks tend to feature brightly lit rooms and wide open spaces. They'll often settle themselves in sunlight or mornings, saving night scenes for romantic or contrasting scenes later in the story. This movie waits until Act 2 for sunshine, and it sets the tone in darkness with magical flickering lights. In the opening, these are the shimmering lights of Coney Island. But Molly's apartment doesn't have much overhead lighting, instead having many wall lamps and fairy lights. Early on in the film, when her power goes out, we aren't really aware because she fills her rooms with candles and the magical aesthetic continues. Sunshine and bright rooms are sources of conflict in this film. Fairy lights are Molly's happy place in the fantasy world. The production design plays a bit of a part of this too. In the plot, Molly is stuck in childhood, like a girl in an adult body. Another director might have picked bright colors to show this, Molly's apartment might have had the pastels of childhood or the pink, orange, and lime green colors of early 2000s girlhood. I can see a version where her apartment is filled with those groovy flower images or the bubble chairs or lava lamps that were everywhere in this era. But instead of depicting her in modern girlhood, production designer Kalina Ivanov leans into a richer, timeless aesthetic. The walls are dark red, the ceiling deep blue with white stars. Molly sleeps in a canopy bed with a cornice over top, covered with sheer golden curtains. She is a princess with a princess bed, complete with a set of steps painted pale gold with roses. Figurines hang from her ceiling, well-crafted, old-fashioned acrobats. There's sophistication here, not just tacky childhood. This is, again, a timeless, magical space. The production design and cinematography work hand-in-hand, too. 8-year-old Ray's apartment is fully modern, painted dark gray with white trim, all straight lines. In the dining room, the wall is paneled with mirrors. That fits right in with contemporary glam aesthetics, but it isn't filmed that way. It looks more like a cold castle, calling to mind the Evil Queen in Snow White, or like some kind of Snow Queen. Elsa's castle in Frozen is filmed this way. And when Molly first looks down Ray's dark gray and white hallway, we're treated to a dolly zoom. This is one of the showiest camera moves you can possibly put in a movie, accomplished by zooming in the lens as you physically move the camera forward or backward. It's frequently used in horror. Hitchcock used it to achieve the effect of vertigo in that film. Spielberg used it in Jaws during a shark attack while Chief Brody is stuck in a chair. Peter Jackson used it in The Fellowship of the Ring as we first hear the Nazgul scream while Frodo stares down the road and leaves magically blow. In this film, it makes Rey's modern-looking home a source of unseen evil, which we'll talk more about in a bit. The editing also works with the cinematography. This movie is filled with dissolves and crossfades that blur the passage of time and space. In the opening, as Molly leaves her apartment building to take a cab to a club for her birthday party, instead of following her trip, the camera pans up to the lighted apartment buildings and then keeps traveling as the buildings and night sky flip into their reflection in a puddle, which Molly steps in on her way to the club. It's dizzying, spinning again, and it also blurs reality. In order to transition from day to night, this movie opts for time lapses, allowing the sun to quickly track across the sky. These dreamlike transitions pull us out of the modern reality of chick flicks with clear establishing shots and logical cuts from scene to scene to a more intuitive journey for these characters. And the characters themselves! Costume designer Sarah Edwards goes beyond convention to tap into fairy tale and fantasy depictions. Molly is meant to be deeply immature, a little girl in a woman's body. She's also meant to be a sexy party girl. It would make sense to keep her in baby doll dresses or bright colors or to give her lollipops and those red-hearted Lolita sunglasses that don't mean what people think they mean. Edwards does not do this. Instead, she dresses Molly like some kind of forest fairy, in dresses and skirts that have a flow to them, with frequent floral motifs. Molly has skill in clothing design and fashion inspiration, so her clothes often feature embroidery or beading, like she embellished her denim skirt or party dress. So she reads more as like a hippie earth mama than a glamorous party girl. It's like she belongs in the woods. Ray is meant to be an adult in a child's body, a 40-something career woman in a school uniform. But Edwards doesn't dress her in business suits. She wears classic, traditional children's clothes, the aforementioned school uniform, a blue button-down shirt with Peter Pan collar, dark headbands and Dakota Fanning's pale blonde hair, cardigans. This calls to mind British low fantasy aesthetics, Lucy in Pauline Bain's illustrations for The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, or Alice in Alice in Wonderland. So Ray still looks like a fantasy fairy tale character, even if she's on the page meant to be the down-to-earth practical one. So why do all this? Why choose to film this odd couple comedy through the lens of a fairy tale? I think Joaquin's vision here works to draw attention to the thematic truth of these characters. They aren't actually a girl trapped in the body of a woman and a woman trapped in the body of a girl. They're actually both lost little girls, fairy tale characters from two different kinds of stories. I'm going to get into the plot here. I generally try not to be spoilery when I'm talking about movies I expect you probably haven't seen, but I need to explain the real heart of this story, the reason it's at all worth checking out, what makes it better than all the other early 2000s modern comedies. In the second half of this film, trying to cheer Ray up, Molly takes her to Coney Island. She doesn't realize the season hasn't started yet, and they walk through the empty thoroughfare to the sounds of a haunting, melancholic score by Joel McNeely. On the way home, Molly tells Ray what happened when she learned her parents died. It was such a living nightmare that the faces of the people around her twisted into monsters. She had to run away. So she packed a bag and headed to Coney Island, because she thought it was an actual island. The only ride she was allowed to go on was the spinning teacups. Molly tells Ray that she kept spinning, and that really, she feels like she's never gotten off that ride. Molly isn't immature. Molly is traumatized. In Joaquin's vision, she's a little girl lost in the woods, surrounded by the spinning, twinkly lights of Coney Island. And Ray? Throughout the film, we learn that Ray's father is in a coma after a stroke, asleep in his room in that dark, warping hallway. The beeps from his monitors often filter into the background of scenes there. So of course Ray is obsessed with germs and cleanliness. She's terrified of sickness, as it's literally stolen her father away from her. Ray's mother completely neglects her, acting as if she doesn't have a husband or daughter. And so Ray fights for control. She's clean to an inch. She is ordered. She studies ballet and is rigorous in her technique, eschewing free dance. She isn't mature, a woman trapped in a girl's body. She's Rapunzeled herself, locking her girlhood in a tower of rules and order to deal with her deeply lonely, neglected life. At the end of Act 2, Molly encourages Ray to go talk to her dad in his coma, that it will matter to him. And then he dies. Ray reacts by firing Molly through her mother. Molly is frustrated and very concerned, but her time caring for Ray has let her work through some of her grief and trauma. She makes some practical financial choices, even moving into a one-room downtown apartment. And then Ray's mom calls. She's gone missing. Molly finds Ray exactly where we'd expect, sitting in the teacups at Coney Island. In a devastating, wordless scene brilliantly acted by Brittany Murphy and Dakota Fanning, the two of them grab the hub and spin the teacups round and round. To Molly, this is taking control of her life, She is the one turning the wheel. To Ray, this is letting go, allowing herself to spin and spin until she's literally sick in a trash can. When I see this scene, I cannot understand what could lead only 13% of film critics to find this movie at all good. It's quality filmmaking at every level by the cast and crew, led by a director who is clearly lending a very particular vision to this story. Of course, I understand more when we get to the finale, which doesn't work on almost every level. It's saccharine, obnoxious, and uneven, which is, frankly, a script problem. It's the kind of ending you would expect to an Odd Couple comedy. And you know what? By that point, I don't care. A finale is not a film. The teacup climax is so satisfying that I can shrug a mediocre ending. And I'm not alone. There's a whole crew of younger millennials and Gen Z girls who grew up watching this movie at slumber parties, which has led to it being a sort of cult classic. As kids and teens watching it, they got what all the grown-up, stuffy, mostly male critics didn't. This is a story of two lost little girls who help each other to find their way back home. A fairy tale, if I've ever heard one. And if you have the eyes to see it, you might be moved to what you find. Thanks for coming.